Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 5. I'm going to do the entire chapter in this audio, verses 1 through 32. It's a genealogy from Adam to Noah. Adam's descendants to Noah is what we're going to be looking at here. And of course, the purpose of a genealogy is to show the record of the old man and the new man, how the old man had progeny that eventually eventuated in the new man, Jesus. So we want to go from Adam. We want to go to Seth. We want to go to Noah. Then we go to Abraham. Then we go to Isaac. And then we go to the patriarch David. And then we go from David to Jesus. Now, we're not going to get all that far in these genealogies. We're going to go from Adam to Noah. We start now in Genesis 5, verse 1. These are the family records of the descendants of Adam. On the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Now, the likeness of God, that's a synonym for the image of God. Genesis 1:27 says this, so God created man in his own image. He created him in the image of God. He created them male and female. So that means if you look in the mirror and you see the image of your face pretty much matches what's in the mirror. The image matches the source of the image. Now, it's not the same thing as the source of the image. Your face is not the same thing as what you see in the mirror, but it's pretty close. So that shows how close we are to God's image. And of course, God created them male and female, so women are made in the image of God too. Now, why did Moses mention this creation in the image of God here at the beginning of the genealogy? Adam Clark says it's to remind mankind that our miseries don't come from God's creation because God created us in the image of God. It wasn't God's fault that we screwed mankind up. It was our fault. But I say it could be rather that the author wanted to show how valuable mankind was to God. So he says, look, all of this is to show God's creation, that which God created in his likeness. I want to show you how things turned out. It could be either way. Because, you know, you look at mankind, you can either look at the good or you can look at the bad. Made a little lower than the angels, but pretty fallen in sin. Now, these are the family records of the descendants of Adam. There were 10 generations. As we know in Genesis, there are 10 generations. And as we go through these genealogies, we need to remember that not all of Adam's descendants are given. For example, Cain's. Cain's, we've already looked at a little bit of his progeny in the last chapter, chapter 4, but they are excluded. And also collateral branches in Seth's line are excluded. And the genealogy runs all the way to the 500th year of Noah's life. So we don't have every member in these genealogies, every descendant, but we've got the key descendants. We go to verse 2, Genesis 5. He, that's God, created them male and female. When they were created, he blessed them and called them man. And I've already mentioned that this shows that females were created in God's image, just like men were. Women shares in the image of God. So here when it says, and he called them man, it doesn't mean he called them male. It's not referring to the male sex. It's referring to mankind, which includes women, unless you're a feminist. Well, I'm not a feminist. I don't go with all this crap about showing, saying human instead of man and all that kind of stuff, trying to make everything gender neutral, trying to squeeze all the gender distinctions between man and woman out of mankind so that we're all one unisex. Well, evangelical feminists can take that crap and flush it, as far as I'm concerned. Now, there is only one male and female created at this time, which makes this a divine object lesson for monogamous marriage. A key verse, well, at least a verse that reflects this created in the image of God, is in 1 Corinthians 11:7. A man, in fact, should not cover his head because he is God's image and glory, and I'm not going to get into the head covering. I've already done that in my audio on 1 Corinthians 11. Why should he not cover his head? Because he is God's image and glory, but woman is man's glory. And that verse does not mean that woman is not made in God's image because she's reflected man's glory. Man reflects God's image, has God's image, and reflects his glory, and woman has God's image and reflects man's glory. Paul was just trying to emphasize the reflection of the woman's glory of the man. He's not trying to state by implication that woman is not created in the image of God. We go now to Genesis 5, verses 3 and 4. Adam was 130 years old when he fathered a son in his likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth. Adam lived 800 years after the birth of Seth, and he fathered other sons and daughters. Now notice, even as Adam was created in the image of God, Seth was created in the image of Adam. But now, unfortunately, the image of Adam is not as pure as the image of God because of original sin. Man is flawed by the time Adam gets to pass his image down to his son. And by the way, that's where we get the term original sin. Adam originates sin and he passes it down. It doesn't mean it's the first sin. It means it's the sin that originated in Adam and was passed down. Here's a good quote from John Gill talking about the likeness of Seth to Adam. Not in the likeness and after the image of God in which Adam was created, for having sinned, he lost that image. At least it was greatly defaced. And by the way, theologians love to argue about how far the image of man, the image of God has been defaced in man. I won't get into that here. That's kind of a subject for theology. We can still reason. We can still laugh, but our reasoning is clouded, and we certainly aren't as righteous, and we certainly don't make moral choices properly anymore after the fall. I can tell you that much. So Adam lost that image, at least it was greatly defaced, and he came short of that glory of God and could not convey it to his posterity, who are and ever have been conceived in sin and shapen in iniquity, are polluted and unclean, foolish and disobedient, averse to all that is good and prone to all that is evil. The sinfulness of nature is conveyed by natural generation, but not holiness and grace. That is not of blood, nor of the will of man, nor of the flesh, but of God, and produced of his own will by his mighty power, impressing the image of his Son in regeneration on his people. Well, that's a great theological way of saying, of describing original sin. Adam was 130 years old when he had Seth, as I mentioned in the last chapter. The Septuagint mistakenly translates 130 and comes out 230. Point that out for those of you who are interested in textual things. Now, notice that Seth is born here in verse 3. He was 130 years. Adam was 130 years old when he fathered Seth. That does not mean that's the only kid that Seth had. And that's important because Cain's got to have his people that he ran into a city named Enoch, and he was worried about a kinsman avenger. He had to find a wife. Where did all those people come from? They had to come from the descendants of Adam, which we assume happened before Seth was born. I went into great detail on that in the previous chapter, in the audio covering the previous chapter. Adam lived 800 years. The Septuagint has mistakenly has 700 years, according to Gill. We go down to Genesis 5:5. So Adam's life lasted 930 years. Then he died. Now, these are long lifespans, and so theologians have come up with different ways to interpret the large numbers in the early chapters of Genesis. The easiest way is to say that they're literal, as the NIV Study Bible suggests, or maybe they have a literary function. In other words, they're symbolic. For example, Enoch lives 365 days. That's the number of days in a year, thus symbolizing a full life. Lamech is 777 years. Of course, 7 is the number of God. 7 times 10 is 7 times 10 is 100. That's what? 700. Then you add another 7 to that. So it's 7, 7, 7, and 10. Those two numbers, 7 and 10, show up in biblical numerology all the time. 7 meaning the divine number, and 10 meaning the number of completion, perfection, manyness, if you will. Now, by the way, this Lamech is not the same Lamech who was in Cain's genealogy. That Lamech said, I've killed somebody, or either I'm going to kill somebody, and if somebody tries to get me, they're going to be avenged 77 times. That's a different Lamech. But you see the number 7 there in both Lamechs. So people start looking at that, and they say, oh, maybe 7's symbolic of something. There are exactly 10 names in the genealogy, just like the genealogy of Genesis 11, which we'll get to. 10 represents a divine number of perfection, completion, manyness. So these numerical conventions make it likely that the genealogy includes large gaps, and the length of the gaps are summarized in those large numbers. Well, that's a nice idea. That would, of course, get rid of the idea that the antediluvian patriarchs lived so long, but I tend to think it's literal. It means the numbers mean what they say. I mean, after all, one of them was 182 years old. What symbolism is that? So let's assume they're literal. Now, there's much effort has been gone into explaining why the antediluvians were so old. Here's a quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. The most striking feature in this catalog is the longevity of Adam and his immediate descendants. 10 are enumerated in direct succession, whose lives far exceed the ordinary limits with which we are familiar. The shortest being 365, that was Enoch, and the longest 969, that's Methuselah. It is useless to inquire whether and what secondary causes may have contributed to this protracted longevity. Vigorous constitutions, the nature of their diet, the temperature and salubrity of the climate, or finally, as this list comprises only the true worshippers of God, whether their great age might be owing to the better government of their passions and the quiet, even tenor of their lives. So social, religious, moral, environmental, dietary factors made them live long? I don't think so. I mean, I know people today that live in a nice climate and are very even-tempered and pious and moral and so forth. They don't live 900 years. I think that the answer is that sin hadn't had as much time to work in ancient times as in modern times. We have been in this world a lot longer, and sin has had its effect for a lot longer. In fact, by the Western Middle Ages, the average lifespan, I remember reading, was about 35 years old. It's gone up now to about double that now because of medicine. But I really think that the answer is sin is having its effect on the human race, so it doesn't bother me that they lived so long in the antediluvian times. Besides, they needed to because they had a whole world they had to populate. They needed to have lots of kids in order to deal with the vastness of the planet that was not populated yet. Now, people who want to make these genealogies out to be literary, symbolic, they mention that there's an old ancient Sumerian list. The ancient kingdom of Sumeria had a genealogy that contained exactly 10 names, and three of the entries in that Sumerian list lived for 72,000 years each. Sounds like a round number, and sounds like kind of old for one person to be living 72,000 years. So the idea is, well, in the ancient Middle Near East, people didn't do genealogies exactly like their medical records or genealogical records like we do today. Well, there's another option that maybe they're both literal, and then they are the literal ages were chosen sometimes for literary purposes to make a point. Well, maybe so. I'm not going to worry myself too much over that. Genesis 5:5, though, this is an interesting little phrase here. Adam's life lasted 930 years, then he died. Now, that morose phrase, that melancholy phrase, then he died, is all through this genealogy. I'll point them out to you as we go through. And some people say that that shows that this is the result of sin. This is the sad thing that happened. NIV Study Bible says that this "and he died" is a stark reminder of God's judgment on sin. I don't know whether Moses meant that when he was writing it or whether he just stated it as a matter of fact, but it could be. Now, there's one exception to this "and he died," and that's Enoch in verse 24, who was translated directly to heaven. We'll get to Enoch in just a minute. Now we go to the bulk of the genealogy in Genesis 5, verses 6 through 21. I really don't want to read all this to you. I'm going to just read a part of it to you, starting with verse 6. Seth was 105 years old when he fathered Enosh. All the way down to verse 21. Enoch was 65 years old when he fathered Methuselah. So we're going to talk about Seth, Enoch, and Methuselah. Now, I said I was going to point out to the "and he died" as we went through, and I just skipped all that by skipping the bulk of these verses. So let me go back and pick that up. Verse 8, Seth, then he died. Verse 14, Kenan's life lasted 910 years, then he died. Verse 17, Mahalalel's life lasted 895 years, then he died. Verse 20, so Jared's life lasted 962 years, then he died. So you see all the death that's going on along in the midst of all these aged patriarchs. Now in verse 6, the verse I read to you at the beginning, Seth was 105 years old when he fathered Enosh. That does not necessarily mean that he's direct ancestor of Enosh. It just means he's an ancestor. We need to remember that because some of these ancestors can be stretched by left out, omitted names in the midst of the genealogy. Now we get down to verse 21. Enoch was 65 years old when he fathered Methuselah. And by the way, that's not the same Enoch that was Cain's son. That's previous chapter, different genealogy, bad genealogy. This is the good genealogy of Seth. Chapter 4 was the evil genealogy of Cain. This is a different Enoch. Enoch was 65 years old when he fathered Methuselah. Now, Methuselah is well known. You've heard the expression. Well, maybe you haven't, but all my life I grew up and hear people say, oh, that person's old as Methuselah. What does his name mean? Jameson Fawcett Brown says the name means he dieth in the sending forth. GotQuestions.org says it could mean man of the spear, or it could mean his death shall bring. Now, there was an old tradition outside of the Bible that said that Enoch gave this name to his son as a prophecy of the flood, of Noah's flood. Jameson Fawcett Brown points that out, so does GotQuestions.org. According to GotQuestions.org, Enoch was given a revelation from God that the world would not be flooded until Methuselah died. So Methuselah, which translated his death shall bring, essentially means, quote, his death shall bring the flood. In other words, when Methuselah dies, then the flood comes. Well, very ironically, that's exactly what happened, because if you add the years up, you will see that Methuselah died in the same year the flood occurred. Let me read you the logic of this. Methuselah died, this is a quote from gotquestions.org, Methuselah died the same year the flood occurred. Methuselah fathered Lamech when he was 187 years old. So that's 187 years. And Lamech fathered Noah when he was 182 years old. So you add 182, Lamech. Then the flood occurred when Noah was 600 years. So you add 600 years to that. So you got 187 plus 182 plus 600 equals 969 years old when the flood occurred. Methuselah was 969 years old when the flood occurred. Interesting. Then that tradition might be perfectly true. Genesis 5:22, and after the birth of Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and fathered other sons and daughters. Enoch remembers the father of Methuselah. And as I've already said, he's not to be confused with Cain's son Enoch in Genesis 4:17. Different Enoch. Enoch means to instruct, to initiate, to dedicate. Now, he is noted as being a particularly pious man, and I'm going to give you some quotes from various commentators about Enoch to give you a feel for this guy. Quote from Adam Clark, quote, "The astonishing height of piety to which he had arrived, being cleansed from all filthiness of the flesh and of the spirit, and having perfected holiness in the fear of God, we find not only his soul but his body purified, so that without being obliged to visit the empire of death, he was capable of immediate translation to the paradise of God." We'll see that in the next verse. He was translated straight without having to die. Another quote from Clark, quote, "Enoch attained this state of religious and spiritual excellence at a time when, comparatively speaking, there were few helps and no written revelation. Here, then, we cannot but see and admire how mighty the grace of God is and what wonders it works in the behalf of those who were faithful, who set themselves to walk with God." Now, that walking with God, Enoch walked with God 300 years, that replaced lived in the other parts of the genealogy. If the genealogy had been consistent, it would read like this. Enoch lived 300 years. Enoch lived 300 years. But instead it says Enoch walked with God 300 years. And NIV Study Bible makes the point here that this shows that there is a difference between merely living and walking with God. Breathing, anybody can breathe. But walking with God is something else. Here's another quote from Adam Clark. Quote, "The circumstances in which he was placed, he was a patriarch, the king, the priest, and the prophet of a numerous family to whom he was to administer justice, among whom he was to perform all the rites and ceremonies of religion and teach, both by precept and example, the way of truth and righteousness. Add to this, he was a married man. He had a numerous family of his own, independently of the collateral branches over which he was obliged as patriarch to preside. He walked 300 years with God and begat sons and daughters. Therefore, marriage is no hindrance even to the perfection of piety, much less inconsistent with it, as some have injudiciously taught." Clark's talking about the Catholics there. So Enoch was a family man, a priest of his family. Back then, that's what they did. They didn't have a priesthood. They didn't have the Levitical priesthood. So family members ministered God to their family and ministered their family unto God. We go now to Genesis 5, verses 23 and 24. So Enoch's life lasted 365 years. Enoch walked with God. There's that phrase again, walked with God. Then he was not there because God took him. Now, if you just had that verse right there, he was not there because God took him, you could just say, well, he died. But that's different than all the other names in the genealogies. It says so and so and so and so, and he died. But here, he's not there because God took him. So that sounds like he was taken directly to heaven. Kind of like Elijah was taken, 2 Kings 2:10. Elijah replied, "You have asked for something difficult." He's talking to Elisha. "If you see me taken from you, you will have it. If not, you won't." Elijah was taken straight to heaven. Hebrews 11:5, "By faith Enoch was taken away, so he did not experience death." So the author of the book of Hebrews confirms it for us that Enoch never died. He went straight to heaven. "And he was not to be found because God took him away. For prior to his removal, he was approved, since he had pleased God." Of course, we know Enoch's a very godly man. Now, I often try to put myself, whenever I read anything historical, I try to put myself into that historical time and think, what was this like? Because everything is so different in history. Things change, and I wonder what it was like to see Enoch just taken straight to heaven. I don't know. I believe it, though. Now, Enoch was the seventh and culminating entry in Seth's righteous genealogy, as the NIV Study Bible points out. And, of course, the symbolism of seven is obvious. It means divine perfection. So Enoch was a pretty good person to fill that seventh slot. Contrast the seventh and culminating entry in Cain's evil genealogy, as the NIV Study Bible suggests we do. That Lamech was evil personified. Now, that assumes that Lamech had killed somebody when he told his wife, "We got a problem here, wifey. I killed somebody. If somebody kills me, he's going to be avenged 77 times. Well, there's another interpretation of that, as I went over in great detail, that says that Lamech was saying, "I'm going to kill anybody that tries to kill me because I'm innocent. I didn't kill anybody. Just because I'm descended from Cain doesn't mean that a kinsman avenger ought to come after me." So that, to say that Lamech was evil personified, is an assumption that might not be true that the NIV Study Bible is making here. But at any rate, we need to distinguish the two. Lamech's not the same. Two different Enochs too, different genealogies. You got to remember the good Enoch and the good Lamech and the bad Enoch and the bad Lamech. Evil being defined, bad being defined by Cain, and Seth being defined as righteous. The two different genealogies. Now we have a mention of Enoch here, this Enoch that's here. We have a mention of him in Jude 1:14. And Enoch in the seventh generation from Adam, seven, because if you count the names here in this genealogy that we're looking at now, it's seven. Enoch in the seventh generation from Adam prophesied about them. Look, the Lord comes with thousands of his holy ones. Now in the original context, this was probably a quote from the apocryphal book of Enoch, but scholars disagree on that. I'm not going to get into that. But Enoch, in the original context of whatever book it was written in, Enoch was speaking to the antediluvians about the coming Noahic flood, as Adam Clark says. So he says, God's coming with thousands of his holy ones. That just means with his angels who come in judgment. He's coming, he's going to wipe this world out with the flood. Now, Jude took that, and many think he's referring to the second coming, but the Lord's coming with thousands of his holy ones at the second coming. Maybe, I don't know. It doesn't matter. The point is that Enoch was a famous guy. He was righteous. He's even given the honor of a prophecy, which even though it was not an inspired canonical book, it was quoted in an inspired canonical book by the brother of the Lord, Jude. Now, Enoch in verse 23 is said to live 365 years. Adam Clark makes this interesting comment. The best of all the antediluvian patriarchs lived the shortest time. Yeah, Enoch, he's the holy one. He's the godly one. He's the pious one, but he lived the shortest amount of time. How often do we see that? It's not the length of your life that counts, it's the quality of your life. Genesis 5, 25 through 27. Methuselah was 187 years old when he fathered Lamech. Methuselah lived 782 years after the birth of Lamech, and he fathered other sons and daughters. So Methuselah's life lasted 969 years, then he died. There's that, then he died again, showing the sad effects of sin. As I've mentioned before, Lamech here is different Lamech than was the Lamech in Cain's genealogy in the previous chapter. I've already mentioned the 969 years makes Methuselah die in the year of the flood. The math on that is solid. This is assuming the numbers in the genealogies are literal, which is what I do assume. And of course, Methuselah is famous because he's possibly the oldest man who ever lived, at least he's the oldest man in the Bible. That's assuming, again, the numbers in the genealogies refer only to one man and not a collection of people in the gaps. Adam Clark says this quote, "This is the longest life mentioned in Scripture and probably the longest ever lived, but we have not authority to say positively that it was the longest." No, it's not. Maybe not. It's the longest ever recorded in Scripture, though. Genesis 5, 28 through 31. Lamech was 182 years old when he fathered a son, and he named him Noah. Ah, so finally we've gotten from Adam to Noah, saying, "This one will bring us relief from the agonizing labor of our hands caused by the ground the Lord has cursed." Lamech lived 595 years after Noah's birth, and he fathered other sons and daughters. So Lamech's life lasted 777 years, then he died. Now the word Noah sounds like the Hebrew for comfort, and of course that would make sense because Noah's father Lamech said that Noah's going to bring us relief. Well, how did Noah bring relief from the curse? Relief from the agonizing labor of our hands that's necessary to produce crops now, and boy, farming is a hard, hard, hard occupation. You have to clear the forest. You have to drain the swamps. You have to plow the ground. You've got to plant the seeds. You've got to till the wheat. You've got to cultivate the weeds. And then it's awful not if there's a hailstorm or a windstorm or a tornado, or if there's a drought, or if there's a infestation of bugs. It's a thankless task. I've always respected farmers, just like I respect soldiers. It's hard, hard life. But now the question comes, how did Noah bring relief from the agonizing labor of the farmer's hands. Here's three options. He could have invented instruments of plowing. Now, that's a speculation. Might be, though. Gill says another speculation is that Noah was the inventor of wine because he was the first to plant a vineyard. Now, this is interesting. Genesis 9:20 says this, Noah, a man of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard. So that's how they got relief from that now agonizing labor of their hands. They would come in from a hard day in the field and chug a pint or drink some wine, maybe. Or Clark says another way that Noah could have relieved the antediluvians from the curse on the ground was by offering a sacrifice after the flood, and then God would have mercy on them in their labors. I don't know what it was, but it is interesting. And you see, there's one more example of human beings trying to reverse the curse. There's nothing wrong with this. Medicine is reversing the curse. Making woman's childbirth easier is reversing the curse. There's nothing wrong with that. Agricultural inventions and ways of growing food is working against that curse, and God has no problem with that. That's perfectly okay. It's what he gave us brains for, to try to overcome the effects of evil in this world. Now notice that Lamech didn't know that Noah would do this, would relieve from the curse. He said, this one will bring us relief. So he's speaking prophetically. Lamech was. We go now to Genesis 5:32. Noah was 500 years old and he fathered Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now 500 years old, that means that he was 500 years old when he started having these three kids. Now this doesn't mean that Shem, Ham, and Japheth were his first three children, of course. As John Gill points out, the early ones were probably not mentioned. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out that Moses was probably only interested in recording the succession from Adam through Seth to Abraham. There's a purpose in these genealogies. Now, it's interesting that Shem is mentioned first. This shows that he has, quote, superior dignity and excellency, unquote, over the other two, as John Gill says. Why? Because the Messiah was to spring from the line of Shem, because Jesus was a Semite, a Shemite. We see this superiority of Shem in Genesis 9, verses 26 and 27. He also said, praise the Lord, the God of Shem. Canaan will be his slave, so Shem has priority over Canaan. God will extend Japheth. He will dwell in the tents of Shem. That means Japheth, even though Japheth is extending his progeny, he's still going to dwell in the tents of Shem. That means he's going to dwell in the land of Shem. Canaan will be his slave. So Canaan's the slave of Shem, and Japheth is going to live in the land of Shem. Shem has the priority. We're going to get into these famous antediluvian patriarchs, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, because they're the fathers of well-known nations. In fact, in ancient history, people always talk about the Semites. We'll talk about that when we get to the table of nations. I think it is in Genesis 10. Now, there's an interesting thing about genealogies. This is what Adam Clark says. When the scriptures designed to mark precedency, though the subject be a younger son or brother, he is always mentioned first. In other words, the most important guy is mentioned first. So Jacob is named before Esau, even though Esau was older, and Ephraim was mentioned before Manasseh, even though Manasseh was older. Now here, does this mention of these three men follow that pattern? It could be. Genesis 10:21 says, sons were also born to Shem, whose older brother was Japheth. Well, that shows that Shem is younger than Japheth. That's the NIV translation. However, the NIV has a note that says you could translate Genesis 10:21 this way, or Shem, comma, the older brother of Japheth. So, in fact, the Holman Christian Study Bible does translate Genesis 10:21 that way, and Shem, Japheth's older brother. So we're not going to make a strong claim on who was the oldest son here, but we will say that Shem has preeminence because of his descendants. His descendants included Jesus the Messiah. As Adam Clark said, Shem is mentioned often first because through him the Messiah was to come. Now, Adam Clark says that Ham is the youngest son. I don't know how Clark knows that. I take his word for it, but he's mentioned out of order. He's mentioned in the middle, and there's no reason for it that he knows that Adam Clark says. Ladies and gentlemen, I have now finished chapter 5 of Genesis. Verses 1 through 32. We will continue in our discussion of Genesis in chapter 6, verses 1 through 8 in our next audio, when we will take up that important topic of the Nephilim. It's amazing how many people get wired up these days over the Nephilim. Verses 1 through 8 in Genesis 6. I hope you stay tuned for that discussion, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.